My name is John Howard Paulton, but I'm known as Jack. I was born in 1926 on Flag Day, and I always thought that they raised the flags because it was my birthday. You know how a little kid thinks that that's the biggest day of the year, and it might have had something to do with my patriotic efforts since that time. All my relatives that were old enough were involved in World War II, and I served on the USS Lovelace, which was a destroyer escort 198, and I rose up to become a gunner's mate, third class. That's like a buck sergeant, I guess.
And your ship was nicknamed Lucky?
The Lucky Lovelace, yeah, because we came out of it so well, but actually we think it was prayer that made the difference.
And just to start off, could you tell me how you chose the Navy when you enlisted in 1944, how you picked that?
In Sioux Falls, they had the Army Air Base. It was a radio school. And I think there were thousands of GIs in Army drab uniforms walking the streets. And when somebody, a high school graduate, would come back and visit, if he was in the Army uniform, he just blended in and so forth and wasn't noticed. But when a sailor came back, why, the girls all oohed and aahed over the cute little uniform, you know. And so an awful lot of my friends joined the Navy. Different, you know. I knew of some fellas out in California that joined the Army for the same reason. There were so many sailors overrunning the streets and so forth at that time.
Could you tell us a little bit more about your work on the escort, what you did?
Well, of course, we had a bunch of guns on board this destroyer escort. Anti-aircraft guns and so on, and that's what I worked on, maintained. And then we had depth charges as well. If anyone saw that movie, The Enemy Below, I did the same thing on that as far as setting the depth of the ash cans, we call them, as they rolled off the ship. For what depth the captain wanted it to be. And I had the same job as the young sailor that lost his fingers, only I didn't didn't lose mine in that movie.
Could you tell us about where your destroyer escort was during that summer of 1945 and what happened during that time?
We were headquartered in the Philippines, in Leyte Gulf, basically, and we ran around or shipped around to different islands with convoys, escorting them, zigzagging out in front of them, of the convoy to check for any submarines that might be up in ahead of them. Prior to that, we were down there in Leyte Gulf, and must have been early August, we got a call. We were on what is called a ready duty. There was probably about 18 destroyer escorts anchored at this one little island. And when we were assigned the ready duty, that means we had to have steam up to be able to go within a few minutes' notice, weigh anchor and go out to take a convoy someplace. And we couldn't leave the ship for that reason. But the captain did. And he went ashore to the officers' club, and he got completely drunk and passed out. So they signaled for us to send a boat in there for him, and we hoisted him up and threw him on the bunk. And then we got the signal, blinker, signal from the base to stand out of the harbor there to take a convoy someplace. And they wouldn't do that on the radio because a sub could pick that up. but the blinker was shielded, so it was the quiet way to pass a message. And I was working on the quarter deck with the executive officer was in charge with the captain in the shape he was in. And he said, I refuse to take the ship out with the captain in that condition. In other words, he would have been responsible. So he flashed back a message that we had a lack of steam pressure or something, a little problem with it. And the USS Underhill was next to us, and they could read our mail, you might say. And they said, we'll take it. And they did. And then that night, the word came back that they had been torpedoed and blown into and sunk, lost half their men, which would have been about 100 men. So we felt very fortunate that we weren't there, that they did die in our place. But it was interesting that when you look up in Google or something on the record, you know, for the USS Underhill, they describe it as having been sunk way up north of Luzon Island about 3 days later. And of course, we knew it that night, so I believe what we heard. But I think it was probably to protect somebody, maybe our captain in the condition he was in, that they changed the record.
Jack, could you tell us about what it was like hearing about the two bombings, the atomic bombs that were dropped in Japan?
Well, first of all, we took a convoy up to Okinawa, and there was a raid going on. We could hear on the radio the night before we got there. We got there in the morning looking at some of the ships that were hit there. And then there was no raid that night. And the following morning, we left with a convoy to take back. And we were very grateful to get assigned a convoy because most of these little ships were stuck out on picket duty. And the Jap kamikaze planes were picking them off. And the picket duty was to report planes coming in. But so they tried to get rid of them first, and then they could slip in without advance notice. But let's see, the first night out, we heard another raid going on. And the following night, it was mid-August in 1945, and we heard on the radio that there'd been a great big new bomb dropped, what was that, Nagasaki? That perhaps the Japs were going to capitulate. And we were so excited, thinking, well, boy, we won't get stuck on the invasion, which we were thinking we would be, and we would get to go home. So we were up most of the night listening to the radio. And the next night, we were tired and trying to catch up on sleep, and a sub tried to get our convoy. So we got in behind the submarine and tried to shoot our rockets that we had on the bow. It was called the Hedgehog, 24 rockets that went up, and if they hit anything, why, they would explode, and you knew that you'd hit it, but it didn't go off. Actually, what happened was it was still on test fire instead of fire. So we passed on over it, and we dropped our depth charges. And we had on the sides of the ship, we had what were called K-guns. And they shot depth charges off to the side quite a ways, so it made a wider pattern of explosions down there in the water. And we had a bunch of packing cases and so on that were cardboard and wood from the stores that we'd taken on at Okinawa, and we didn't dock them over the side because it would have been a warning or an announcement to any sub that a convoy was going by, and they'd radio ahead to another sub. So we still had that there, and when the cave guns went off, why, that stuff caught on fire. So here we were out in front of the sub with a fire in the night, and we were out and right out in front of his torpedo tubes. And we just prayed that our depth charges that we'd already dropped would dissuade it when we'd be wouldn't get torpedoed. But we ran to get rid of this fire and put our hands under it, and we threw it over the side. And the guy that I had been standing watch with there had this strap around his neck with a mouthpiece and in front, and then earphones on, and it was screwed into the side of the ship. And when he hit the end of his leash, why, he was like a dog on a chain or something. He slapped down on the deck, and we laughed about it later on. But anyway, we couldn't pick up the sub again with our sonar, but we knew he was in that particular area, so we started circling until morning. Then a PBY plane came out and drug a cable through that area, and they couldn't find him. They said he either sunk or got away. So then we hurried and caught up with our convoy again. But we found out later, at the end of the war, that that was the last night they'd ever heard from that sub. So we knew that we got credit for sinking the last sub that was sunk, actually, in World War II, that I know of, anyway. Of course, the next night after that, why, there was a second bomb dropped. Then we got down to Lady Gulf, and, well, President Truman announced September 2nd was the official VJ Day. And there were thousands of ships in Leyte Gulf waiting to go to Japan that fall. They had all these rockets on board for lighting up a beach or whatever, so they were shooting them off. And it was the most fabulous man-made display of fireworks that I've ever seen, that probably ever was. And it went on for hours and hours. As far as you could see, there were ships, and so there was this dome of skyrockets and candles and everything going off there for hour after hour. You might as well, you know, they used them up. Oh, we were elated and so on like that. I think of that every time I see a 4th of July fireworks display. Then there was one other hazardous time we had. September of 45, we still were guarding some convoys, and we took another one up to Okinawa. There was a big typhoon coming in, and we got loaded up with oil again and steamed out into the East China Sea. The waves were so tremendous. One minute you'd be way up on top of a wave looking down on this canyon all around you and thinking, you know, it's strange we don't fall off. And a minute later, we were down in this canyon with this huge wall of water all around us and so forth. And we took 62-degree rolls in that. 45, you know, was halfway between straight up and horizontal. And so we were worried, are we going to come back up again? But we always did. But that went on for about 3 days. That was a spooky time.
What did you know about the bombs that were dropped, the atomic bombs? Did you have any idea what they were?
No, all we heard was it was a new bomb, and it was real big. That's about all we knew about it. But we were grateful for it. You know, we were scheduled to be in on the invasion, and we had lost so many men at Okinawa and Wake Island and so on. And it would have been a lot worse at Japan because, you know, it had been house-to-house type of fighting. They would have fought to the last man, you might say. But with this great big bomb, and they didn't know we didn't have another one, why, it was a good out for them to accept it. And it saved, you know, millions of lives, really. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers' lives, maybe in the million even there, plus millions of Japanese lives.
And then how long before you actually got home?
Well, our ship was due for some overhaul and so on like that, so our whole squadron got to come home. It was six ships. left Subic Bay on September 1st, 1945, and it took 21 days to cross the ocean to San Diego and leave home.
And how were you greeted when you arrived in San Diego?
Well, that was kind of funny. There was some very nice ladies with milk and donuts out there on the dock. And we tied up at the dock and went ashore there. And I hadn't talked to a lady for many months. And I was kind of excited, I guess, getting milk again and so on. And I spilled it down in front of me. And this lady took a tea towel and was wiping me and so on like that. And the rest of the guys got to laughing at me because my face was just as red as a beet. Got a train to Omaha, and my family met me there.
Did you think about continuing in the military, or did you just decide?
Not at all. No, I was anxious to go to college, and it's a good thing I had that break because I was tired of high school. In fact, I'd gone to high school, summer school, so that I'd graduate in 3.5 years. I was afraid that I'd missed the war, and all my older brother and my older cousins were all involved in it, and I'd always been the tag along behind them, and so I wanted to be a part of it too.
When you were out on the boat at sea, how did you keep in touch with your family?
Just by letter. The first letter I wrote after I got on the ship, I wrote and told them all about the armament we had and how many guns and so forth. And the officer that censored my mails called me in, and he said, there's no point in trying to cut out some of this or black out because it's so full of it. He says, you just can't talk about that stuff. So I didn't on the rest of my letters.
Is there anything else about your World War II experience that we haven't talked about that you'd like to say before we end the interview?
Not that I know of. There was a great deal of patriotism, you know, anxious to get in and do your part and so forth. I know before, while I was still in high school, my dad was assigned a whole neighborhood to be responsible for blackouts when they practiced it. And he wasn't in very good health, so he assigned it to me. And so I'd go around and check on it with these attorneys and doctors and so on like that and tell them you've got certain problems in your block that you've got to get after them. And they didn't appreciate it from a high school boy. But anyway, what I'm getting at is that it made it, we were more a part of it. And with rationing and so on like that, we knew we were at war. And then, of course, most homes with right age people from it, men or women, had stars in the windows and so forth.